University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Richard Morin, an infectious diseases specialist in Lincoln. His lecture is entitled, The Many Facets of AIDS. Morin has worked extensively in the treatment of AIDS patients, both in Lincoln and Connecticut. In the past 2 years, he has given nearly 50 major presentations in different infectious disease topics, including several on the subject of AIDS. Currently in private practice, Morin is on the medical staff of Lincoln's three hospitals and the Veterans Medical Center. He has been certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine. Morin is a member of the Nebraska and American Medical Association, and he is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at the University of Nebraska College of Medicine. Join us now for Dr. Richard Morin and University Forum.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? We got the PA on, and I do hope that everybody can hear. Let me start off with, I like to give very informal talks. So that means if there's a question or I say something that doesn't make total sense, please raise your hand. We'll clarify it or answer your question. I think that it's essential for this kind of a presentation that we have a chance to address concerns or what have you during the talk. Sometimes people are a little reticent to bring up a question, and that's fine. There will be a talk back, and also you can approach me individually if you have a particular question. Let's start off with a little bit of information about what do I do. I am an infectious disease specialist. That means I treat infections. There's about 7,000 people in this country that belong to the Infectious Disease Society of America who specialize in infectious diseases. We're a funny bunch of people. I'll be honest with you. I'll give you for instance. At the last infectious disease meeting, the national meeting that we had in New Orleans, when you signed in at the registration booth, they also were signing up people to participate in a study to see if you could catch germs from eating the raw oysters. I mean, is that not funny? I mean, it really puts a damper on your life. I mean, we go around washing our hands all the time. But anyway, when we first... say in the late 70s, there was a concern that there were too many infectious disease people. Then AIDS came about, and boy, did things change. I take care of people with AIDS. I took care of them in Connecticut, and I take care of them here. And that surprises some people, because some people are still under the misnomer that there's no AIDS in Nebraska, that that's something you catch in San Francisco, or someplace exotic like New York. And it's by funny people who do funny things. And I'm here to kind of dispel some of these misnomers and hopefully provide some information that will make an impact on not only your lives, but your family, and also your contribution to the state and the nation in dealing with this problem that we call AIDS. Let me first of all provide some definitions, because one of the problems we run into since AIDS come about is we got this whole kettle of abbreviations. You have HIV, HTLV-3, STD, all these kind of things that people just kind of glibly slip out without much explanation, and it's somewhat confusing to the average person. We start off with the word AIDS. AIDS is an abbreviation for a thing that we call the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. And a syndrome is basically a group of symptoms and observations that people make about a disease. The next thing is we talk about HIV. And what HIV means is an abbreviation for human immunodeficiency virus. And what we feel is the cause of AIDS. Other symptoms that we talk about, other symptom complexes that we talk about, is called ARC, age-related complex. And I'll get into that in a bit. Let me give you a little historical perspective of this syndrome. Way back in 1981, when most of you people were in school, in high school and whatnot, or some in grammar school even, there was a strange observation made in New York City. In a matter of a couple weeks, four young men who were apparently in good health arrived in the emergency rooms at various hospitals in New York with pneumonia. And it was a pneumonia that was caused by a germ known as pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. Now, this is a rare germ. Nobody was supposed to see it. The average infectious disease person was supposed to see one or two cases of this in their entire professional life. It was so rare that to get the medicine to treat this pneumonia, you literally had to call up the Center for Disease Control and say, "I got a case," and they sent it to you. That's how unusual it was. What we knew about this infection was that it only showed up in people who had something wrong with their immune system. And these four patients weren't supposed to have anything wrong with their immune system. Or did they? When they started looking at these patients, they didn't fit into the categories that we saw before. They didn't have leukemia or cancer. They weren't severely malnourished. They weren't on big doses of steroids, the type of things that we usually associated with this type of pneumonia. But what we did notice is that they had some other funny things. They seemed to not have the usual things that people are supposed to have in their blood. And one of the things they were missing is a cell called the lymphocyte. And everybody said, "That's weird. Where'd their lymphocytes go?" Other observations were made. All four people were gay, and very actively gay, and started making people scratch their heads and say, "What's going on here?" About the same time, the same observations were being made in San Francisco and in L.A., and within a matter of a year, practically all over the country. Certainly made people ponder. And once again, we didn't know what was going on. It seemed to be predominantly in gay people. We started recognizing it was also people who were doing IV drugs. And the first concern was, what's causing this? Now, as soon as you start raising those kind of questions, people come up with all kinds of theories. And there were some people saying it was God getting even with gays. There are other people that are trying to explain it as a natural phenomenon that we didn't have an explanation for. You know, it's kind of like we don't know theory. There are other people that were concerned that it was a phase of the moon. Actually, we used that theory before. And the last time it was in the Black Plague. We said it was because of the constellation of the stars that was causing it. So we kind of dusted off that theory again. And then there was another group of people who study infections, what we call epidemiologists, that scratched their head and said, "You know, this is strange. This is acting like it's being caused by something that's infecting these people." And even before we knew about the virus, we were being very suspicious that there could be a virus. Within the next couple years, there was a great effort to try to identify what germ was causing this. And just about every germ you could think of was blamed for it for at least a few days. Until some people at the National Institute for Health and also in the Pasteur Institute in France almost simultaneously came up with the discovery of a virus. And it was a virus that we knew about for a long time. It belonged to the family of retroviruses. Now, for years we knew about retroviruses. They were felt to be relatively innocuous type things. They might affect animals, but people seemed to be immune to them. But lo and behold, now we have a retrovirus. obviously there was panic ensuing, saying, well, you know, how is this virus being spread? Why is it picking on these people as opposed to anything else? And we soon found that there were certain groups and certain methods of getting it. We found out that you could get this from having sexual contact with somebody who had the virus, so it could be spread sexually. We found out that you could get it from a blood transfusion, from the blood being obtained from somebody who had infection. We found out that you could get it from being born of a mother who was infected. We also found out how you couldn't get it. It did not seem to be something that you could pass casually. In other words, you couldn't get it from shaking somebody's hand or living in the same environment with somebody who was infected. We soon found out that there were certain groups that were particularly prone towards this virus. And the first group was obviously people who were gay. The next group were people who were IV drug users. The next group were people who were receiving blood transfusions or blood product transfusions, such as people with hemophilia. Another group were heterosexual people. The last group was people who were born of somebody who was infected. And then there's a group called unknown. Now, let me define a little bit about the unknown group. These were people, one, who could not give us information as to what would put them in a risk group, or did not want to give us information, or died before the information could be obtained. In this country, you don't have to tell anybody anything. Ask any two-year-old. They'll tell you. So what we realize is that this virus was particularly prominent through sexual transmission. Now, we also were getting reports that from Central Africa, the same thing was going on, except there was much more higher in the heterosexual population. And the concern was there something different? Were we dealing with a different virus? And it didn't seem to be the case. It seemed to be the same virus, except that the social norms really didn't encourage homosexual behavior or IV drug use, but did encourage the frequent use of prostitutes. And it was not uncommon for people to have a stable home with one or multiple wives and also frequent a prostitute. Now, that's not to cast aspersions on particular cultures, or it's not to imply that these people are hypersexual or something like that. It just means that this provides an opportunity for a sexually transmitted disease to be brought home with the bread. And sure enough, we found that in a short time, people who were sexually active were acquiring this particular infection. And in Kenya, interestingly enough, the infection did not start in the rural area, but appeared to be disseminating through the urban areas. And it seemed to follow along the truck routes, that the long-haul truckers were the ones that were frequenting this prostitutes in various truck stops. And with it came the disease. With time, you started seeing it in more rural areas as people went home. And with time, you started seeing it in children born of parents who were infected. Now, in this country, where the disease first showed up in homosexual people as opposed to heterosexual, the rate right now is that there's a chance of 13 to 1 male to female. So there's 13 to 1 male to female. Now, the statisticians tell us, don't worry, we'll have equality once it gets around more. Now, to me, that's little consolation. But it appears that there's a greater chance of a female acquiring it from a male than a male acquiring it from a female. And it probably has to do with the concentration of the virus in semen as opposed to in vaginal fluids. Ain't that something to worry about? Now, what's the implications for us The implications for us is that we realize that there's a lot of people who are out there that have infection. Now, when we first start talking about AIDS, we think about everybody as having AIDS, the full-blown syndrome. But what you have to realize is that there's a whole spectrum of HIV infection. On one end, you do have people who are dying of what we call AIDS. And to be considered AIDS, you have to have certain criteria that have been established by the Center for Disease Control. And AIDS in this country is a reportable case. In other words, I have to notify the local health department by law if I see a case of AIDS. On the other hand, there's a group in the middle that are referred to as ARC. And the best way of saying this is that these people are getting sick. They're not sick enough to be called AIDS, but they're getting sick. And like one patient told me, he said, it's kind of like having the flu all the time. So they can have fevers and chills, diarrhea, not feel well, not have much appetite, no get up and go. Now, I will admit that all of us probably this winter have had days that we felt that way. But can you imagine feeling that way all the time? On the other end of the spectrum are what we call asymptomatic HIV infection. These are people that feel fine. They have the virus in their system. We know they have the virus in their system because our blood test can measure it. But on the other hand, they don't know they have it. There's no little voice in you saying, you're sick. There's no sign on your forehead that says you got something. And you can't tell. The only way we can really tell is to do the blood test. Now, the problem we run into is that for our 100,000 people with AIDS, there's probably about 2 million people running around this country who are infected. And of those 2 million people, they have the potential of spreading it to somebody else, unbeknownst to them or their partner. Now, somebody will say, hey, look at dummy. If you can measure it in the bloodstream, why don't we measure everybody's blood? And then we can take all the people that are positive and put them in a camp. We'll put them on, you know, we'll put it in Rhode Island. It's small. It won't take up much room. Well, there's one little catch. Just because your blood test is negative today, if you are involved with high-risk behavior, there's no law that says that you can't get sick tomorrow or acquire the virus tomorrow. So what we would have to do is call a moratorium. No sex for 6 months. Right? The first day of the 6 month, everybody gets tested. Everybody in the country. And then 6 months later, we check everybody again. And only those people that are positive, we ship to Rhode Island. Now, that sounds like a great idea. As my wife again. She's right. The idea is never going to catch on. I mean, we've already tried prohibition once. What happened? People drank. Can you imagine outlawing sex? That won't work. So we're going to have to scratch that idea. What can we do? Well, we have to find other plans. We have to treat the people that are sick now. And we then have to take action to prevent other people from getting sick. Let me talk a little bit about what we're doing now for people who are sick. Up to now, I should say, let me go back a bit. Up to 1985, we did not have a good blood test to tell who was or who wasn't infected. In the spring of 1985, we developed such a blood test. And the first thing we did is we decided to test all units of blood. So anybody who ever donated a unit of blood, that blood unit got tested. And if it was positive, we threw it out. And what happened is that we reduced the infected units of blood. And we've reduced it to the point that it's probably, the chances are, probably on the average of 1 to 100,000 to as much as 1 in a million that somebody can get an infected unit of blood through the current testing. We then turned around and said we should test people who are at high risk. People who are involved in behaviors that would put them in contact with this virus. Now, the problem you run into is, what do you do with that information? Okay? I tested you. You turned out positive. Congratulations. Don't sin anymore. That was the problem. We couldn't protect that information. And people who were positive were subject to discrimination. I don't want you living in my house. I don't want you on my school bus. God knows, if you're in the fifth grade with my little Johnny, all hell's going to break loose. So for a while there, we were actually discouraging people from being tested. We were encouraging people to, if you thought you were in a high-risk group, avoid chances of spreading it. But don't get tested. In about 1987, a medication came available called AZT. AZT is a virus medicine that seems to stop the virus from reproducing. It doesn't kill the virus, it just kind of puts the brakes on it. And when we first started using this medicine, we were literally using it on people who were dying of AIDS. And we realized something funny happened. The people who were getting the real drug as opposed to the sugar pill were living longer. Matter of fact, the first study was planned originally for 3 years. And after 6 months, the medical ethicists who were reviewing the study said, "Hey, folks, time out. The people who are getting the real stuff are living. And they're living so well that it is unethical for you to continue this study. Everybody should get the real McCoy. Nobody gets the sugar pill." And we did that. They stopped the study, and they started giving everybody AZT. Everybody was in the study. And sure enough, they found some people getting better. We then started saying, should we use AZT on other people? People who aren't so sick. Maybe we can keep them from getting sick. And that's what we've done. We started using it on people who have the ARC. And in some cases, we're using it now on people who have the asymptomatic infection but have some blood indicators that would make us think that they will get sick in the near future. It's made a great difference. We now have something to do. And we've encouraged people now to start getting tested again, because if they are positive and they are in categories that would encourage them to be on medication, we have a chance of preventing them from getting sick. And I'm a great believer, if you can prevent it, that's the best way to cure it. Now, there's one little catch. AZT costs over $200 a month. I don't know about you, but that's going to chew up petty cash real quick. That's going to dip into the beer money, the play money, the rent, and the food money, all in one fell swoop. It's not a drug without side effects, and therefore you have to monitor for those side effects, and that means having a blood count at least once or twice a month. That's $25 a whack. So we'll give it twice a month. So we're now talking about something that's going to cost greater than $250 a month. Whoops. Now that sounds wonderful. And in this country, though, we do have the resources to absorb that kind of an expense. And we are able to get people on AZT, even if they don't have the resources, through Medicaid and other programs such as that. In the state of Nebraska, they have literally set aside monies in which we can draw on it for people to get on AZT if they have no other resources. Now, unfortunately, it's only $40,000. And if you think of it a second, $40,000 doesn't go real far if you're spending $200 plus a month for one individual. But it's something. And for what I use it for is a stopgap measure. I use it to get people on the medication until we can find other resources, be it Medicaid or what have you. So that's made a difference. But let's take this on a global perspective. Let's go back to Kenya, where it is possible that 10 to 20% of the entire population are already infected. We're talking about third world nations that have, for resources, probably $40 per capita per year for health care. What can you do for $40? In this country, you won't even let you sit in the emergency room for $40. Let alone do much more. The average person spends $40 easily on birth control pills. You just figure it out a second. You can go through $40 just on birth control pills. Let alone all the other things that we consider essential for health care, like immunizations and vaccines and well child visits and all that fun stuff. So these countries cannot afford the burden of $200 a month per person who's infected. It's become an overwhelming burden to these countries. The other area that we've done better is treating the infections that we associate with AIDS. Remember, I talked about that infection called pneumocystis. We have now come up with not only treatment options from going from one drug, we now probably have about, 6 to 8 drugs that we can use to treat this infection, and probably 10 different ways in which we can treat it. We've also come up with ways in which we can prevent it by having people use medications in a preventive manner. We have been able to reduce the incidence of people having their first pneumonia bout or recurrent pneumonia bouts. And that's made a substantial difference. So we're not waiting until someone's literally gasping for their last breath before we provide treatment options. We can provide treatment options before they even start coming down with pneumonias. And that has made a difference. And if you look at people's survival rate, it has made a big impact. When AIDS first was being reported in 1981, everybody died. Now it's not near that. And we're having people live 4, 5, 7 years since time of the original diagnosis. So that's made a difference. Other things that have come about are a raising of social consciousness. In 1981, we all knew there were people who were involved in gay activities, but nice people didn't talk about those things. In 1981, we knew there were people doing IV drugs, but nice people didn't think about those things. And the biggest problem we had, the biggest obstacle we had, was social inertia. You had people both on the local level, the federal level, state level, in addition to the general populace, who really could care less if gay people were dying. It was kind of like, don't bother me. I don't have anybody like that in my neighborhood. We had one, ran him out last year. Made a big difference. Suddenly we realized that as the numbers started growing, that it could be our son and our daughter, our brothers and sisters, our parents who are getting this infection. It suddenly came home. We couldn't use denial anymore. And we still had to shake up people in government to say, let's spend money on this. At first, we were spending more money on B-1 bombers than we were spending on AIDS research. Now, I will grant you, We were having many more people dying of heart disease and strokes than we were of AIDS. And we probably always will. But what we are talking about is an infection that with reasonable research, we can come up with some options for treatment, as we have already. It's only in the last several years have we sort of turned around and started looking at this as our national health problem that needs some interaction. We had a Surgeon General who decided to take the bulls by the horns and issue a report and be very frank with people on how this is spread and what you're supposed to do to stop it from spreading. It was kind of surprising that he was able to do that. And he certainly should be applauded for his efforts. Once again, though, we are still having a component of social inertia. We've got the feds moving. We've got the state moving. We've got local county health departments moving. But we still have a component of social inertia. Because the average person says, that happens to somebody else, but not me. I'm safe. I wouldn't even think to do those things. I cheat a little on the side, but it's all right. It's right here in town, you know, and I'm discreet. Or somebody tells me she limits her sexual partners to once a month. Of course, she has a new one every month. And not realizing that what they are involved with is relatively high-risk behavior. The ideal thing at this point is for everybody to internalize the fact that they can be involved at behavior that would put them at high risk. And the responsibility for changing that behavior lies within themselves and not the other person. And it's very difficult to get people to realize that. The other thing that's come about, and this is something that I know that I had to go through, is we had to throw aside our prejudices and our opinions of people. And we had to realize that just because someone's involved with certain behaviors that we don't approve of, that doesn't mean that we can castigate those people. We cannot suddenly view them as socially expendable. I know in my own dealing with patients with HIV infection, I had to realize that I had my own prejudice as far as what I view as acceptable sexual behavior. And I had to realize that what's all right for me is not necessarily the standard that everybody is going to adopt. And in doing so, I suddenly became more accepting. And I could deal with these people as individuals and not stereotypes. People say to me now, how can you take care of somebody with AIDS? Aren't you afraid of catching it? And I reply, no. First of all, I don't do IV drugs. And second of all, I think it's unethical to have sex with my patients. I'm not going to catch it from touching my patients, from examining my patients, hugging my patients, because sometimes they need a hug. That isn't how it's spread. And I've had to, as a health professional, show that to other health professionals and demonstrate by my actions that I accept these patients. And it's only by doing that have I gotten people who are other health professionals to realize that they have to look at their own prejudices and discard them. It isn't always easy. I remember a particular situation where this young woman came to me. She was 23 years old. She was referred to me by the obstetricians. The woman is pregnant. And as part of the screening that the clinic was doing at the University of Connecticut Health Center is they were doing HIV tests on all pregnant women. And she was positive. And they sent her to me because, well, hey, they don't do that stuff, you know. They were afraid to talk to her about this. So they said, let Morin do it. He'll talk to anybody. So I sat down. Now, this woman was currently unmarried. Her sexual partner was currently in prison. We don't know if he was positive or not. Difficult to call up the prison and ask. But she did have a lover prior to that time who was an IV drug user and who has since had died of AIDS. Now, what I realize is that there's a 50% chance of the baby being born with the AIDS virus and being infected. And that there's a 50% chance with that, that if the baby's born, that the baby will die within the first year of life of AIDS. Now, my first opinion was, hey, lady, get an abortion. And then I talked to her. And I said, have you thought about getting an abortion? She said, yeah, but I don't want to. And I said, why not? And she says, because I have a 9-year-old boy. And he's now getting to the point where he doesn't stay around the house too much anymore. And I'm hoping that this baby will love me. Suddenly, she's looking for love, for being wanted as a mother. And I instantly realized that I had to take all my prejudices and my opinions and stuff them. And I said to her, I'll take care of you. We went through the entire pregnancy. It sounded like I had the baby too. I didn't. She did. She did fine. All her numbers and all that stuff indicated she was an asymptomatic infected HIV person. She still carried the same risk of passing it on to the baby. The baby was born fine. Cute little boy. Had all his fingers, all his toes. Seemed like a real smart kid. As much as you can tell, a little 1 year old, 1 day old. The baby, 6 months later, was still negative. We're probably out of the woods. Now, there's a situation that as a healthcare provider, I could have forced my prejudices on this lady. And the effects that it would have had on this lady would probably be disastrous. Now, I'm not trying to condone her misconception that babies ought to give you love. That's not my philosophical belief. But for that woman, that was important. And it's my job as her healthcare provider to support her, to provide the care that she needs. One of the things we talked about in the introduction was the effects of this on the family. Now, you have to remember that AIDS is an individual infection, but there's no way that it cannot affect others within the society, within your family unit. Try getting the flu and not bother anybody else. Right? Okay. It's kind of like, I am so miserable. And you're coughing and hacking, and everybody around you becomes concerned. But that's okay, you're getting the flu. It's socially acceptable to get the flu. Everybody does, nice people do. But what about AIDS? That's not a nice disease. You didn't catch that from your neighbor who sneezed on you like you do the flu. That's polite. You say gesundheit. No, you were doing IV drugs, or worse yet, you are screwing around. things that nice people aren't supposed to do. I'm thinking of one situation. This is a young man, 19 years old, sexually active, and not too discreet about it, and certainly not too smart about it. He's HIV positive. Now, mom and dad kicked him out of his own home because they happened to be rummaging through his closet. Just happened, you know how it is. And found a gay magazine. Mom and dad consider themselves very religious Christian people. So they kicked him out. I always thought that was a real Christian thing to do. What they basically did is disown this kid because they couldn't live with the fact that he was gay. Then when they found out that he was HIV positive, they really couldn't deal with it. Luckily for the kid, he does have other relatives that have good sense. And they realize that kicking him out is not the way to deal with the issue. That the issue is that this kid, if ever, needs support. I'm thinking of another situation in which I ran into a patient who told me that he told his friends and family that he had leukemia. And I said, why'd you do that? He said, well, I didn't know how to tell him that I was gay. And I said, what do you think they'd say if they found out you were gay? He says, I don't know. And I said, do you want me to talk to them? And he said, would you? So we had a family conference, and we talked about a lot of things. And after the conference, the father said to me, he says, I always knew the kid was gay. He just never told me. But in the process of doing so, a lot of things came out that they could deal with. They could put the cards on the table and deal with it. And the kid found out that his parents loved him just as much as ever and rallied around him as opposed to kicking him out. There's all kinds of tragedies in this world. And I think that with this particular disease, we're realizing there's a lot more tragedies than we ever wanted to admit. I told myself that I would give time for answers and questions. Let me kind of pull out some salient features that I'd like you to take home. One, AIDS is a virus. It's a viral infection. And it's spread to people by known ways. It's spread by intimate contact with people or their fluids. So if you want to call intimate contact getting a blood transfusion, yeah. It is not spread by casual contact. You can't get it from having somebody cough on you, sit by you in a classroom, be your roommate, or anything like that. Okay? There are ways in which you can be tested for it. And for those of you who just happen to have a piece of paper and a pencil out, let me tell you about a way in which you can get tested in this county anonymously for free. There is a state program that is run through the county health department in where you, as an individual, can get information in a confidential manner. Your blood can be tested, and only you know the results. There's no record of it kept. And if you would think that you might be at high-risk behavior, or are just concerned and would like to get tested, please call this number. The number is area code 402, if you happen to be out of the area, 471-8065. And tell them I sent you. You don't even have to tell them that. At this point, the system is set up in which we are testing people age 19 and older. We are trying to expand it to include children or people less than 19 years of older without parental consent. And the law is trying to be revised in that manner. It's quarter of. Let me stop here and throw it open for any questions. Question?
Well, you said you couldn't get AIDS. The fact of the matter is you could get AIDS if you stuck yourself with an infected needle.
That's true.
Now, as I understand it, nationally at the moment, it's illegal to test anybody for AIDS unless you get their specific written permission. Now, when a patient comes into a hospital, any hospital, they sign a general permission and they can be tested for any disease known to man, including syphilis and other diseases that we used to be considered not nice.
Right.
But they can't test it for AIDS.
Right.
Therefore, you're putting everybody who works in the health professions at risk. Is there anything being done about this, or do you think anything should be done about it?
I don't know. Did everybody hear the comment? The question is, first of all, that I could potentially get AIDS from a contaminated needle, then that's true. There's a small risk. The risk at this time from getting a needle stick from a contaminated patient, that it's 0.84%. Okay? So every time I get a needle stick, I run at risk of 0.84% chance of acquiring an infection from that patient. Now, let me put that in perspective. Another common virus that's transmitted the same way is hepatitis B virus, and that carries a 29% chance. So we're talking about a very effective way of getting it for hepatitis B and a not-so-effective way of getting it from a needle stick with AIDS. What about protecting our healthcare workers? At this time, what we have done is we've adopted a policy nationwide of what we call universal precautions. We assume that anybody and everybody could be infected. And that's why when you go to your dentist, he wears gloves, or should be wearing gloves, when he's working on you. Now, it's not that he suddenly realized you got germs in your mouth. He's already figured that out. It's just that he's trying to minimize his chances of acquiring viral infections, particularly. And we found that to be effective. Well, what about emergency room people and healthcare providers in emergency situations? Once again, we do the same thing. We try to wear gloves and whatnot. Now, it's not to cast aspersions on your personality if you get in an auto wreck and the emergency workers are all wearing gloves. They did not find any secret. We just assumed that anybody could be potentially infected. And taking that attitude, we have minimized the concern about, is the test back? Is the test real? Should we wait until the test comes back before we provide health care? And it seems to be, at least from what we can understand right now, a fairly effective policy. Now, in time, when we get better ideas of how this virus is stored in the body, so to speak, and get better tests, we might be able to come up with better ideas of how to minimize our exposure as healthcare workers. Other questions? Question? All right. The question is, what about people now who have had in the past been sexually active but are now considering setting up a monogamous relationship? If you think that you might be involved in high-risk behavior that would jeopardize a future relationship, One option is to get tested now. Okay? If you are negative, then you make a pact with yourself and that other person that you two will develop a relationship that you are sexually active only with each other. Good old-fashioned monogamy. That means you two can fool around all you want, but with each other only. There's some distinct advantages to that. It takes the fear out of being close. And that's one option that I have been proposing to people. Now, it can be done in a manner in which it is confidential. You don't have to broadcast it. Now, there was a law passed in Illinois that said that anybody was to get married who was applying for the marriage license had to be tested, like we used to do for syphilis. It was a great idea, except it didn't work. You know why? Everybody went to Wisconsin to get their marriage license. They skipped the border. When they finally, after a year, they looked back at all the testing they did, and they found out they found one case. And they did like about, I think it was 80,000 tests. And when they found out and they investigated that one case, it was somebody who was involved with high-risk behavior. He was an IV drug user. I mean, it didn't take any mathematician to figure out that the risk and the cost of doing this broad testing really didn't justify finding that one case. That if the person getting involved with that IV drug user had asked some very pertinent questions like, "What are all those funny marks on your arm?" they wouldn't have had to worry about it. Would have saved a lot of people running to Wisconsin to get their blood or get their marriage license too. Other questions?
What would you say to someone who said, "If I've got it, I don't want to know about it because there's nothing I can do anyway, so I'm going for my own peace of mind, I'm going not to be tested"?
At one time I would have said fine. What I've been saying now to people who approach it that way is saying, that's true, but what you have to realize is we have treatment option now that could prevent you from getting sick down the road. And though there is some definite worries associated with knowing it now, we might be able to, one, protect others, and two, prevent you from getting sicker. And the other thing that I always provide with people is that when I do testing, at least, is that I don't just say, "Here, get your blood test, call me next year." I always make it a point to follow up with these people to provide counseling. If they need psychological counseling because of the concerns and whatnot, I will arrange for that. So I don't leave somebody out in the cold having anxiety reactions. Question?
People that wear the gloves, does that actually protect them from getting AIDS? Because you said that you can get it only through IV and sexual.
What it does is that it prevents you from getting blood and whatnot on your hands and minimizes that. Now, obviously, a needle is not will not be deflected from a rubber glove. But it does prevent some of the direct exposure to blood on hands. There has been one case of a healthcare worker who did have a rash on her hands, who did have prolonged exposure to blood, and who has subsequently become HIV positive. In other words, she has the antibody in her bloodstream, which would reflect her infection. But she has not gone any worse than that. Okay, so that's why the tendency is to use gloves. Any other questions? I know that we're running into overtime.
Yeah. How long after you get infected before it's detected as a test? Is there a certain period of time?
Okay. The question is, how long will it be after you've been exposed to the virus? Can you come down with antibodies in your bloodstream that the test will pick up? It can be anywhere from 6 months. And probably 99%, well, probably grow to most like 99.8% will acquire it within 6 months. There have been a few reported cases of people that have gone as far as 13 months, but that's the exception to the rule than the rule. So usually what we say to somebody is that if you're concerned, we'll test you now and repeat it in 6 months.
Well,
and don't do anything in between time that would put you at risk. Other questions?
Dick, what about saliva? I've heard conflicting reports of AIDS.
Okay. The question was, what about saliva? There have been studies that have demonstrated that you can recover virus from saliva. There's only one little question. You need a beaker about this tall, full of saliva, to require it. As I tell people, even if you French kiss, you got to be pretty damn sloppy to get that much saliva. Thank you very much for your time.
Today's speaker on University Forum was Dr. Richard Morin. His topic was The Many Facets of AIDS. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts university located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 programs at the university.